Thank you for listening to Upaya's Dharma Podcast, an extraordinary series of talks from some of the finest Buddhist teachers in the world. I'm Joan Halifax, founder of Upaya Zen Center, and we're so happy to make these podcasts available to you. If you find this talk of benefit, please consider making a donation to support us to continue offering these recordings freely. You'll find a donation button on our podcast page. And thank you so much for listening.
This is show number 948. It was recorded on March 19th, 2014, and it is titled From Aging to Saging. The speaker for this episode is Rabbi Malka Drucker.
It's such an amazing experience to speak to a group of people who have been sitting 20 minutes, a half an hour in a place of stillness, that the open ear of the listener opens the mouth of the speaker. So you're collaborating with me tonight. Thank you. So although I always think when I come to Upaya, you know, it's one of these opportunities to leave the mundane and enter into eternity, I'm actually here with news tonight for all of us. The beginning of the 20th century, the life expectancy was 47. Life expectancy now is over 80. So the news is, we have an extra developmental stage as unique as adolescence. We have 34 more years. Now, I know, I just turned 69, but I know that when I was a child, people retired at 65 and died at 70. It wasn't like a lot of time to have to worry about what you were going to be doing later. But we're in a very different position. And because of these 34 extra years, there is opportunity that has never been had before, which is to have the longest period of maturation for wisdom than any other generation, on top of which we have technologies that allow the harvest of many, many traditions. Now, in some ways, this is nothing new, because all civilizations until the Industrial Revolution relied upon the longest-lived members of the community to tell the stories, to remind the community of who it was. And they counseled the leaders about everything from when to plant crops to when you went to war. And they were the ones who initiated the young into adulthood, and they consoled the mourners. Their years gave them the calm reflection that balanced the dynamic of the middle. Because you see, in some ways, and this is not my idea, actually it was here in this very spot that I heard Jane Fonda speak about the three acts. And the first act of our lives is with our families of origin, and we're directed in that way until we reach the second act, which is the hero's journey, where then we make the world, we make the family, and it's entirely directed towards that. It's not until the third act, however, that we come to an understanding, really, of what the first two acts were. And it's not until the third act that we finally, inescapably, if we're lucky, inescapably, discover an inner life. Now, I know I'm speaking here to the choir. Everyone sitting before me is clearly very connected to one's inner life. Yet the inner life of the third act, we'll talk about in a moment, is a little different. This is a big conversation among my peers at dinners. This is what we talk a lot about. What are these years and what does it mean? And what it seems to me is that there are four ways to age. The first way is, who's aging? You know, like Roshan from California, I know that dance, you know. You just keep doing what you've been doing, you know. It's like the seven stages that Erickson sets before us, and we have adulthood. So Mary Catherine Bateson suggested there's adulthood one and adulthood two. Adulthood two are these 34 extra years. Many of us figure, well, hell, we'll just have, you know, we'll just have 50 solid years of doing whatever we do. Maybe not as well. Maybe not quite as quickly. But we're just going to keep on doing it. So denial is certainly one path. And that, you know, for a lot of us, you know, we can really keep doing this. And yet, the sine qua non for becoming an elder and not simply elderly is coming to terms with aging. It's the first step, without question. You want to know what the second step is? You all know what that is. What's the second step? Dying. Coming to terms with dying. So, second path. Second path is for those who've really not had a very good time in the second act, and in fact are absolutely exhausted from it, and have been just waiting for the day that they come to the time when they can essentially relieve themselves of entire responsibility of being a human being, going on cruises, and basically not caring about anything except themselves. So that's the other path. And there, I mean, you know, and I'll confess, I know these paths because I own them. I managed to do all four at different times. Not at once, but at different times. Third path is not denial, the opposite. Third path is the one that really the doctors love, because this is for the individual who knows only too well of the diminishment of the physical life and spends all their time going to doctors, trying to be cured of the pathology known as aging. So the three paths that all of us do to some extent, and yet the fourth path is the one that seems to be the secret of a further journey that many of us had no idea even existed. Because again, remember, we're living 200 years after the Industrial Revolution, and really, we don't have any idea of what it's like to live in community where elders have the power. It's the opposite. We've only known the world of speed, the world that values youth above all else. So, if you were, say, in India, the boy would want to be the grandfather, because that is the one who is respected and listened to, and that was once a principle of every civilization, and we understand that we have no imagination for such a world. Anthropologists will tell us about it, but we ourselves don't trust it. Worst of all, we don't trust it in ourselves. And that there are very few of us, as we approach, say, 60, saying, I can't wait. I'm going to be 60 years old. This is a wonderful thing. So that there's no relationship outside ourselves that's going to really support this. So one of the things that I discovered was that women's groups in the 70s, women's consciousness raising, were essentially incubators for a new vision of women, because they surely weren't seeing it anywhere outside. And that woman had yet to be born. And yet every woman in those circles knew and reflected it in one another, the new vision. And in some ways, the work of becoming the sage or the elder cannot be done alone. It needs to be done in community. And most of my teachers, the ones who really, really have done the greatest work in this, did not begin this work as I did, when I discovered inescapably that since the passion of my life had always been myself, now that I had reached a certain age, saging was going to become my new subject. For many people, it was a grandmother who died in a way that 25-year-old knew was the path, and that set them on the path. So I'm always happy to see the younger people at UPAYA, because I happen to think that this work, first of all, it's much of the work that you're doing already. It's just done with a different intention. And that when you already have the practice and you reach the age of 60, then you recognize what the real reason for this practice has been your whole life. For a really spectacular finish. That's really what it's about. So, in such a world in which we live, and many of the conversations revolve a lot around technology, and technology is spectacular for the person who no longer has the same physical vigor, and yet there's also a sense of being left behind. And there is no place for the conversation of a world that has loss, sickness, dying, and death. And there's no sense that there's any future for the one in the third act. There's no picture of one who's going to live this extra developmental stage. So I think that in many ways that this is a time, especially for communities like this, for UPAYA, other places that I've spoken, where this work becomes not simply, say, the work of a social worker or a chaplain administering to those that we designate of being elderly, that no, rather, it's seeing our lives as a hologram, and that regardless of our age, this one, who knows, has always been with us, and that the practice develops this one. Now, the practice, besides slowing one's life down and incorporating forms of meditation like this, and gathering in groups with regularity to have the conversation, also includes other tools. Some of the tools I'm sure many of you practice already, which is journaling. But some of them, I'll bet you don't do. Because they're the things that we did when we were children that we enjoyed and we found great richness in the imaginal world. And that as we grew into adulthood, we left that behind. And now in the third act, we find that the way we do repair of our lives and the way we do life review is in a playful way. It's in the way that we allow the memory to come, and we recognize that when the memory comes, however it should come, driving in the car, consciously sitting, meditating, and a grandparent comes to you, a scene when you were 4 years old, whatever it should be, your relationship at that moment to what comes to you, a message, a messenger has come to me. I will stop now in my life. I will listen to this. I will revisit that place, wherever it should be. I will smell it, I will hear it, and I will watch myself in this scene. And if this was a scene, say, where I'd been terrified or humiliated, or whatever happens in the nightmare that we call childhood, now we realize that the past is not immutable, that we can change. We can change the past as we remember it and as we have carried it our whole lives. And that is part of the work of being an elder as well, to do this. And elders have always done this. And this is what the great excitement and adventure of these years are. Because until now, most of us, regardless of how much therapy we've had, regardless of how long we've sat, are carrying around a lot of stuff. And it is at this time of life that we develop a new relationship to it. And there's an ability to say, I can become now who I've always wanted to be. It's a liberating time. The loss becomes the way to freedom. And that is why, that statistically, when they go around asking people who has most life satisfaction, it is actually people over 65. You know that Gallup had a poll. It's about 3 years ago. Gallup did this poll of who is the happiest American. Like, where do they live? What do they do? What is their gender? And how do they know, you know, their measure for happiness was they asked people how often they smiled in a day. That was the measure. And so actually, did anybody know about this? If you remember, yeah, this is in the New York Times. It was very funny. So anyway, so they actually, this is the demographic of the happiest person in America. This person, which gender do you think? A man. Life is much better for, it's easier for men. I mean, let's say something. This man lives in Hawaii. He's 69, they found him. He's 69 years old, and he's married. He's married. He has children, yes. He owns his own business, and he makes more than, I don't know, maybe $125,000 a year or so. I think that's what it was. Here's the part that I really liked. The best part was that this person from Hawaii was an observant Jew. That was... And they found this guy, Alvin Wong. He was an observant Jew. Anyway, so. How much time do we have? And our time left? Good, okay. So I'd like to leave some time for questions and response as well. I really never, as I said, I never thought about this part of my life until I reached this part of my life. Yet I read this book called From Aging to Saging by Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi, who in fact is going to be here. He actually won't be, but he'll be here by Skype. With Roshi next month at the Spiritual Directors International with Richard Rohr. Anyway, so Reb Zalman was approaching 60. Life was going reasonably well, professionally, personally, and yet there was this nagging depression. And the depression came from living in a world that at this time would make him invisible, increasingly, and less powerful. So he went to Lama in Taos and spent 40 days there and came back with this vision that there should be eldering institutions, you know, like Esalen, places to teach us how to take this place not only for our own well-being, so that we have some reason to be alive at this time, but also because this is what the world is missing. There have also been studies around things like altruism, empathy. Not always, God knows, but the opportunity for a unique kind of empathy and altruism that can take place at this time, so that there's relationship to future generations and a caring, is very, very important. So Reb Zalman came back, very enthusiastic about this, wrote the book From Aging to Saging, and created a national office for people to create the institutions to do the teaching so that we will have an elder population. And not surprisingly, it was not successful. Not successful. And when I spoke to him about this 6 years ago, when I read his book and it finally reached me as really for its great wisdom and its great hope for the future, I wanted his permission to continue doing this work, he essentially said to me, look, I'm fixing to die, because he's going to be 90. You're fixing to get old. You do whatever you want to do. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. In fact, he has a book coming out called The December Project. And the reason it's called The December Project is that he understood that you could divide our lives by the months. So January, 7 years, the number seven, bless you, is a number of wholeness and perfection. So January, 7 years, 0 to 7, February, 7 to 14, etc. So Zalman now is in his December years. I think it's 78 and up. And in looking at this, this is another way to look at one's life, is in these seven-year intervals and what we remember most keenly for each of these periods. And doing this work with others, look, there are ways to talk about, we can talk about aging, we can talk about many of us feeling that there is a certain well-being we were surprised to have, and a certain fear of leaving center stage. We can talk about this forever. It is the practice and the stepping into the place of the elder that is what it takes. So when Zalman speaks about the sheer triumph of just reaching a certain age, it seems to me that when I started to read this for myself, I started to feel like it does, you know, like day after day, the accomplishment of getting up, carrying hope, working on those things within oneself, but especially as one ages and there's no expectation. And I think in some ways, women have unique opportunity in this place to gain wisdom. Because, I mean, Roshi taught me this a long time ago. The real benefit of being a woman in the world and trying to get something done is you can work under the radar. No one has any expectation of you to do anything. I mean, whatever you do is going to be spectacular, you know? I mean, nobody's going to... So it's the same thing here in the same place of the elder. I mean, the expectation of, you know, anybody... You can see your children begin to look at you differently. You know, it's sort of like, in some ways, in this world where it's... That we cease to have usefulness in a certain way, and it feels terrifying in a world such as ours. Let me just say to you that this is not a new thing. The sense of the one who no longer is useful in society and our relationship to that one has always been present. There are 10 commandments, another tradition from this one. You know those 10. Okay. Fifth commandment, according to my counting, is the one of honoring your parents. Honor your father and mother. Now, here's the thing about commandments. There aren't any that come naturally. They're all counterintuitive. I do not need a commandment to be envious. I'm fine with it, you know? I don't need any commandment to fear. I don't need any commandment to be impatient. I mean, I'm good at this stuff. The commandments are for the stuff that you're not going to be able to do very easily. So here's a commandment to honor your parents. Not even to love them. Simply to honor them. And it was really understood to mean, this is not for a 10-year-old. 10-year-olds naturally honor their parents. At least one would hope. It's when the parent of the grown child no longer has purpose for that child. That's the purpose of the commandment. So relationship to the one that no longer has full power has always been a challenge. It's not only in our time. It's just that we have institutions that have set up a world that support the prejudice and the fear, because the one who is aging reminds us of death. And that's really, and nobody wants to know what's really going on in the internal life of that age. And the more those who are that age are seen as diminished and useless. And this is more in chaplaincy, when I've spoken to the chaplaincy groups here, that though that population ceases to have its power, ceases to have its place in the world. So, when we finally get to the third act, and we find ourselves no longer defined by others, and we are finally face to face with ourselves, we finally come to understand that we do have another part to play by not being center stage. And I see this for myself as it's sort of my responsibility in my community to sort of cheer on the young, to be cheerleaders for them. And I can do that because I've been there. And I know what that time is. And I remember that the sense of you just have to live long enough seems truer and truer. I don't have to say it, but I can stay in that place. I can be in that place. And I think that that image, you know, when we were children, that you leave the house and your mother was in the kitchen and you came home and there was your mother still in the kitchen, having not moved those 7 hours you were gone, waiting for you to come home, and there are cookies beside her, you know, that's it. That longing for that presence in our lives, in some ways, is the place of the elder. Because that there is that sense, especially with children, Zalman talks about that the children and the grandparent have a common enemy. And they both are, in coming in different directions, or in a different place from the adults in the world. They may have a little more time, and they may be able to be with each other in ways that the adults in the world cannot, because they're busy doing their hero's journey. As I said before, this generation of sages in training has an advantage of longevity that no other generation has had. And it also has, and we have opportunity also, in these years that we live, we're not decrepit. It's really different. You know, it really is amazingly different. Somebody just wrote me today that their 87-year-old father was just operated on. It's a major surgery. It's like astonishing. The world in which we live, how long people are living, but not only that, but how well and how vigorously we're still living. And in this time, by living these extra years, the question is going to be, are we going, of those three paths that we don't want to take, of those three paths, I remember Joan talking about her parents living an extra 40 years and essentially not doing anything. That if we have this time, what will we do with it? Especially in the time in which we live. It's a very, very terrifying time in a lot of ways. With all the blessing of it, there really is a question for those of us who are looking at children at this moment in time, and what will the world be that we're going to leave to them? Legacy is a very important part for the elder. That really, am I going to leave the world in any way, a little better than I found it? So I think that in some ways, this vision of this time of life that so many of us really dreaded and then found ourselves in, you know, baby boomers were the Peter Pan generation. We thought if we didn't grow up, we wouldn't get old. And then we found ourselves, and again, we're different from other generations. I mean, baby boomer burials are going to be very different from burials. Everything's going to be very much on the terms of this generation. And yet, even though there's more time, the timetable is the same. Life will be the same for all of us. And I think that the most exciting thing about it is that we have the potential to do this repair and to do it consciously and to do it personally in our own lives. And imagine if this became, in fact, the portfolio of people who decided at a certain age that now the time will come, that I will devote my life to growing wisdom, which is a process. It's not a thing. It's something that we will continue to do, that for each of us will be different. But in many ways, what I think wisdom is about our relationship to the future. And in a world that has a lot of fear about the future, it seems to me the more that we can grow within ourselves a clear sense of what our own purpose and our own lives are about, the better it will be, the more light there'll be. Enlightenment is a natural process. It's natural to grow wiser. So I'm going to guess we have about 10 minutes left.
You're exactly right.
So we've been working together a while, so it's good. So now I'd like to sort of just open things to response and questions or whatever. And disagreement. I mean, I come from a tradition where if you don't disagree, you're not paying attention. So.
You spoke about people losing their power as they age, which is creating a construct about your image of yourself in relation to other people. And I know in the Vedic tradition, for instance, this final stage of life is the time when you fulfilled your responsibility to your children, you fulfilled your responsibility to your work, your dharma in life, and that's a time that you recede, you go to the forest, or you do that internally, and you begin to develop your relationship, not so much with other people and defining yourself that way, but with a higher self, whether we call it God or wholeness or whatever. And I just would love to hear some comments about this aspect of that stage of life.
Well, yes, it's also in the tradition of carrying the beggar's cup and being free of all that, for sure. I want to ask the question. How many in this room are at that stage? What is your name?
My name is Ralph.
Ralph has described. How many feel that sense of well-being at this stage? Oh, good. Right. And those who've raised their hands, could you say a little more than that about what the experience is?
I liked your comment so much, Malcolm,
the future. And I think one of the things, one of my jobs in my family, and I guess with others, is to sort of say, hey, I lived a long time, and I learned a lot, and I've lost a lot, and I've been dumb, and all of those things. And I can sort of help it sort of help for them. And I have almost a sense of urgency now. I'm 80, raised 85. And when I'm around my kids, I'm more open with them. And it's like I'm teaching them now. I'm the teacher. And I love that whole experience. And it's very satisfying to me because they give back a lot of love.
Beautiful, Nancy. Thank you.
Well, I'm well into that third stage by age. There was an interesting article in the New York Times the other day about age and wisdom, explaining basically what you're saying, the fact that even those of us that are older, we do have wisdom that sometimes just takes us a little bit longer to come to the conclusion that our younger cohorts might think they come to very quickly. And it's interesting that, of course, my mind doesn't work as fast as it did when I was 30 or 40 or 50 or even 60, but it still works. And people still realize that, you know, I still have a brain. And so it's difficult, though, when they look at you, they think, oh, that person is old and it's time to get new people and youth. But there is something to give, I think. You know, there is something to bring to the table still, even though we have lost some of our power because we're no longer 40 or 30 or whatever.
I thank you. Bless you. Thank you for your honesty about that. I find it useful to use a four-world model on this. It's Jungian and it's Kabbalistic. There's the physical world. There's the world of the heart, the world of the mind, and the world of intuition. So the diminishment of the physical and the intellectual, the mental. The other day I was thinking, I went to rabbinical school late. I was 51 when I went to rabbinical school. So I thought I was old, you know. And I realized, you know, I could never go to rabbinical school now. I could never do what I did. It's not just a matter of stamina. It's a matter of, you know, like learning Aramaic at 51, I assure you, was a noble effort. It was a noble effort, you know. It's like, but now, you know, so I think I found myself accepting it completely. Of course, I can't do those things I did mentally. Why could I accept it? Because I've also experienced expansion in the other worlds, the other two worlds of the heart and intuition. Because I think if we didn't, and it was just diminishment, I mean, we would kill ourselves, for sure. But the reason that the point of it is, in some ways, look, the great example of conscious aging actually came with Beethoven. Not when he was so old, but at the height of his powers, as we all know. He'd written 8 brilliant symphonies, right? You know, really good symphonies. And then he went deaf. And then he went into a depression, and for a long time didn't produce another symphony. And then, bingo, the 9th, nobody before or since. So whatever that dark night was for him was essential for his genius. And I think that that's one of the things that we also learn, that the reliance upon the things in the physical and intellectual world that we live our whole lives around, only when they're not there do we realize what remains for many of us. For many of us.
I'm just stepping through the threshold to the third act. One thing I'm noticing, I'm curious to know if you think about these transition points are kind of fascinating. So stepping out of the hero's journey from a period in life, I feel like I know nothing anymore. Like, I thought I knew so much. You know, you have to know a lot, quote unquote, to kind of get through the hero's journey. And then when you're kind of through it, it's like you have to unknow what you thought you knew and maybe let a lot of it go. I'm just curious to know your thoughts about that transition out of the hero's journey and into the third act.
It's a very good question. I asked Reb Zalman about this too. Like, if I'm like going full speed ahead in teaching staging, isn't there some disconnect here? I mean, I'm supposed to be like, you know. And he said, well, just, you know, take a nap and then go back to work. This was the answer. So I didn't get a feeling like this was like, you remember the three ways that, you know, this wasn't like, sure, go on a cruise, you're done, go play tennis, you know. No, you have to work very hard now. Maybe harder than you ever worked before at a different thing, just as you're saying. You confront suddenly what you thought you knew, you depended upon. That boat doesn't sail quite as well as it used to for you. Something else has to be operating for you. And in some ways, for a lot of us, there's a discovery of one's being that was never possible before. It's ironic at this stage. I've sat with many people now, you know, who get very enlightened, you know, in the last 10 minutes of their lives. I mean, really, it's like it's being confronted by, you know, the fatal illness or whatever it should be. And that's And sometimes never, and sometimes never. But for those of us who are willing, remember I talked earlier about playing at, you know, revisiting a scene? You can also go the other way. You can imagine your last day. Imagine your last evening. Who's with you? All that. Not because you know, we're all, you know, control freaks. That's how I want it. Now I figured it out. I'm going to write it down so they're going to do it for me. No, Sherwin Nuland just died. He wrote this wonderful book, How We Die. Brilliant book. Any of you who have any interest in the subject or in chaplaincy, you really have to read How We Die. And Nuland's point is, it's a mess, dying. It's not an easy thing to do. It's complicated, you know. You know, 1 in 10,000, you know, is going to be like Lou Reed, you know, going out smiling. You know, most people not going to be like that. And that's all right, too, to know that what I imagine its value is in telling me who I am. Something about what my longings are, what my fears are. So I think that what happens is that we get much easier with what we don't know. That's what's different. That's very relaxing. I love that. You know, it's just that part that I don't have to know all the things I thought I had to know. Yeah.
Then a follow-up on that. What advice would you have to someone in their 20s who understands the value of conceptual knowledge, especially in a technology-driven world, wants to balance silence and wisdom with progression?
Well, you're in the right path, clearly. You know, and you have a wonderful teacher here, you know, who's on Twitter all the time, right? Yeah. So, and also, you know, my teacher, Reb Zalman, is also a techie, and his metaphors are always around, you know, like, you know, download that, you know, that great zap of love, you know, I mean, he uses that metaphor. So I think in a lot of ways, balance is the whole dance, for sure. And I think that you need to live in the right time for yourself. In your 20s, it's appropriate to be in a place of looking to the future, for sure. What comes to mind is this. A year ago, I was diagnosed with a serious surgery. I'd never had anything wrong with me before. Everything was fine. Until this, you know. And I saw with my children, and because this happened, boy, did I move into staging fast. Oh, my God, you know, every profound, eternal question came to me at once. I was really looking at my life from a new perspective now that I thought I could be dead, you know. It's like it never occurred to me before. With all the staging I've been doing, nevertheless, this was new for me. So now I want to talk to my children, you know, about, you know, the big stuff that's coming up for me because of this. There was no faster way to get my children to, like, you know, empty the room. They would be gone the minute I just, you know. It's like, because, and I learned from them. It's not appropriate for them to be looking through that lens at this time. Not appropriate for you. Balance is appropriate. Living in the new tech, you know, living in the world is appropriate. And keeping yourself connected to your soul is appropriate. But that, you know, don't worry about saging. It's enlightenment is a natural process. We're biologically wired to go that way. So you'll find yourself there.
Would you say there's any particular special role for the 1 in 5 of us now who will never be parents in elderhood?
Well, you could do better than those of us who do have children because you won't be distracted by them and you can, like, help many more people. Whenever, you know, this is in the Talmud. The Talmud says that when the time comes and you are face to face with the one who made you, there will be four questions. And the first question will not be whether you ate a cheeseburger. That will not be the question. The question will be, did you deal fairly in business? That's the first question. Second question, did you set aside time every day to study? Third question, did you have children? Fourth question, did you keep hope for the future? And I see those two conflated. That, look, you can have one, two, you can have six children. It's not enough. Your sphere of concern as an elder in this world, as a human being, is to care for that generation. To care for that generation. I think it's very important. And I think that we have to be, in many ways, grandparents, you know, like the grandmothers, that the archetypal grandmother, the grandmother's heart, is a heart that belongs in every one of us.
I have a question. As a friend of those aging and moving into that process, how can this younger generation support them?
Ah, that's a wonderful question. Well, I think that first of all, to see them as more than diminished, but as wise, having something to teach you. What may amaze you is that when you take that posture, you see a shift in them, because they're seen differently. So, and I think that it's important. You know, it's, again, as I said, the young person growing up in traditional society wants to be the elder. Certain societies, you walk up to somebody and you say, "You've aged. Thank you." So for you to recognize that here is one who is a teacher and can serve as mentor to you is probably of great benefit to you as well as to them. Always wonderful to speak at UPAYA. Wonderful people. Thank you.